Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I'd like to welcome all of you back to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder. Today we're going to be discussing creation, the universal consciousness, and the human spirit. But I'd like to start again with Edward Albert Meyer, this one-armed farmer from Switzerland, who's in always about 77 years old now. He lives in a tiny mountain village about an hour east of Zurich that's called Hinterschmidruti. His writings answer all the big questions in life. Who are we? Where do we come from? What's the purpose of our life? What happens after we die? Who and what created our universe? What the seven evolutionary steps of human societies are? What are the other extraterrestrial human civilizations in our Milky Way galaxy like? What was the ancient Earth like in the past? And what was our solar system like in the past? All of these very deep and profound questions are answered by the Meyer material. So how does a simple farmer from Switzerland with about a fifth grade education, how is he able to answer these deep and very profound questions? Well, according to Edward Albert Meyer, he has had extraterrestrial contact since about the age of 5 years old, and he grew up in a little town called Niederflux, which is close to Bulach, Switzerland, which is, again, probably that not that far from Zurich either. But his initial contact occurred in the Horrigan Forest, where he was given a telepathic message to go out into the forest and wait. And out of the sky came this pear-shaped craft, which landed in a field nearby, and out stepped this extraterrestrial man that Edward Albert Meyer had had contact with previously via telepathic messages. So young Billy wasn't afraid of this elderly Plyaran man who walked over to him and brought him into his ship and actually took him up some 70,000 meters above the earth, where young Edward got this beautiful bird's eye view of the beautiful blue world that we call planet Earth. And he looked around inside the ship and he saw these displays with people on them. At first he thought they were windows or portals, and he realized that they weren't. And Svath told Billy that he had had previous lives on the Earth for the past 13,000 years, and that his spirit form had been Enoch, Elijah, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Emmanuel, and Muhammad. And that in each one of these lifetimes, he taught an ancient universal teaching called the teaching of the spirit. But that over the millennium and over the centuries, that this teaching had been distorted by human religions and that the real message had been lost. But in this lifetime, Edward Meyer's writings will be saved in their original form. So in the future, here on the earth, the people of the earth will have access to this information. Now, the spirit form of Edward Albert Meyer has been on the earth for 13,000 years, incarnating as these various teachers and prophets. And I want to read something from an interview that Billy did some while back, where he talks about maybe what it's like to have a spirit form that old. And he was asked the question, how do you feel being among the people on Earth when your original birthplace was in far higher regions? And Billy says, while my original birthplace lies billions of years in the past, I continue to feel connected with it at all times, and I do not deny that I often long for it. Nevertheless, I am now at home on earth, where I have many dear friends throughout the world, but this does not alter the fact that I am often extremely lonely. The fault does not rest with my friends, but it is generally prompted by the influence on me by the state of the spiritual and consciousness-related terrestrial world, which is so dissimilar to the world that my birthplace and in effect still is. So here young Billy is sitting in this craft with this extraterrestrial man named Spot, who is telling him that his spirit form has lived lives on the earth as well as on other worlds, and that he's been a teacher and a prophet for many, many years. So Spot places the device on Billy's head to unlock the wisdom in his predecessor personalities. And Spot tells Billy that in the future, his life will be very difficult, that people will try to kill him, that his own wife would call him a hoaxer. He was also told that stay in the background and focus on your writings because other people will come forward to tell your story. Now, one of the central themes in the Meyer material is this idea called the creation. And the creation is the superintelligence which created our universe, but it also is the universe itself, or the physical structure of our universe. And if you could step back and view our universe, it would be shaped like an egg that's made up of seven different circular counter-rotating layers. And the fourth layer in that egg is the material belt. And in our material belt contain the planets, the stars, the solar systems, the galaxies. And it's very interesting because we have repeating patterns in nature. And I was just watching a film on YouTube that talks about the work of Victor Schauberger, a naturalist and scientist in Germany who studied water. And the Meyer material says water itself has a spirit form. But one of the interesting things is that water flows in a spiral pattern when it is in a river. It's supposed to flow in a spiral pattern, which is extremely interesting because our DNA has a spiral to it, and seashells have a spiral. And also, the galaxy itself spins in a spiral. So let's listen to this clip that talks about the spiral galaxy with a secret.
The NASA ESA Hubble Space Telescope, with a little help from an amateur astronomer, has produced one of the best views yet of nearby galaxy Messier 106, a striking spiral galaxy with a number of secrets. Located a little over 20 million light-years away, practically a neighbor by cosmic standards, Messier 106 is one of the brightest and nearest spiral galaxies to our Milky Way. Although it may not look particularly unique, some of its features have baffled astronomers for years. Messier 106 has a supermassive black hole at its center. Although this is true for most galaxies, this black hole is particularly active and hungry, gobbling up nearby material at a startling rate. This huge black hole's bottomless appetite is behind much of the galaxy's unusual behavior. Messier 106 appears to be emitting powerful radiation from its center, something we do not see with our Milky Way. This is caused by the very active black hole at the galaxy's center, which violently drags gas and dust inwards. This material heats up, emitting bright microwave and X-ray radiation as it does so.
So these black holes in our galaxies, they bring matter in a swirling spiral way, much the way you'll see spirals forming in rivers the same way. You remember the passage from the Goblet of Truth that says, that's entitled What the Truth Knows to Say. The first word in that little passage is rivers. It says rivers, stones, lakes, plants, animals, bushes, trees, everything that crawls and flies on the earth is a life form with a spirit form. And these spirit forms are on a journey through time, which involve many, many lifetimes. And that death is just the passage to rebirth, rebirth into the world of pure spirit. So death is just a passage. And our spirit forms spend about 150 some years in the spiritual realm, typically, and then our spirit form is placed back into the body of a child 21 days after the sperm fertilizes the egg. The spirit form goes into the midbrain in an area called the superior colliculus. The superior colliculus is the area that controls many things like sight. And the energy from that spirit form flows out into the entire body and animates every cell of the child. And the child, at that point, starts his consciousness evolution. The comprehensive consciousness block comes down, makes sure the child gets a new personality, and the wisdom of those predecessor personalities are placed in the subconscious. So as the child grows back up, he'll get inspiration from his previous personalities as well as impulses from the storage banks. And that's how wisdom builds on top of wisdom every lifetime. It's very interesting because Semyase, Billy's actual third extraterrestrial contact, told him that everything is within the human. The human represents the microcosm within the macrocosm. And that's, again, she's talking about these repeating patterns in nature. We have the spiraling in our DNA. There's the spiral that forms in the river as it flows downstream. There's the spiral on the seashell, the spiral in the galaxy. Let's listen to another clip. This clip is about the largest galaxy in our universe.
There are about 100 billion galaxies in the universe. For roughly 13 billion years, they've swarmed around each other, colliding and merging, undergoing rapid star formation and suffering periods of drought where no new stars are born. They range in size and shape from small dwarf galaxies to the beautiful and graceful mid-range spiral galaxies to the gigantic and ancient ellipticals. The smallest, the dwarf galaxies, can be as small as 200 light years across and not much more massive than a star cluster. They contain as few as 100 million stars and act as shepherds of most of the spiral galaxies we see today. The largest galaxies in the universe are the ellipticals. They are featureless collections of very old stars that range in shape from nearly spherical to highly flat, and contain as many as a trillion stars. So an intriguing question to ask is, of all these giant galaxies in the universe, which one is the largest? What is the largest galaxy we've ever seen? The answer is this one. Known as IC 1101, this galaxy is located 1 billion light years away in the constellation Serpens. This is the largest galaxy in the known universe.
It's hard for us to really visualize the size of creation. And remember, our universe is one of billions of universes. And there are actually millions of human races. When our universe was created, there were some 50,353,607 different pure human races created by creation. Over 40 million pure human races that have evolved in our universe. And that is 343 different skin tones, the Meyer material says. And these human beings can look very different. Some are giants by our standards. Some are dwarfs by our standards. But all of these human life forms have a human spirit that reincarnates into the physical for a certain time and then moves back into the spiritual realm. I want to read a little bit from Omphalon Mirado, Canon 14, that talks about the spiritual realm. On this side of Earth is the life of the coarse mattered material and the learning period and evolution connected therewith. But in the space of the other side is the life of the spiritual and the evolution of the spirit form connected therewith, and also the preparation of the spirit form for the reincarnation into a new body takes place in the space of the other side. So when you're in the spiritual realm, your spirit form is being prepared for your next reincarnation into a new human body. You notice the term death is almost a misnomer because it's just two forms of life. You have a material life and you have a spiritual life. So you iterate back and forth between these two states. And this side and the other side equally occupy the same place. However, separated by two different dimensions, that is by the visible and the palpable material plane and the invisible and impalpable spiritual plane. So the spirit world, the fine matter world, occupies somehow the same space as our planet, but a different dimension. Therefore, two different dimensions are given, the material plane in which the physical life fendeth for its being, and the spiritual into which the spirit form of man floateth after death of the material body to live on the other side. And in verse 15 of Canon 14, it states, therefore man liveth and dieth, and is born again into a new body. And this type of becoming and passing away repeateth itself until the time of time has arrived, at which the spirit form of man, as a minute portion of creation, does not need a material human body anymore for their evolution. There are seven stages of life. We have the first stage, which is the primitive. The second stage, which is rational life, which is what we are here on the earth. We're considered rational beings, even though we don't always act that way. Then the third stage is intelligence. The fourth stage is called real life, and many milestones occur in real life. Human civilizations start to become real space travelers. They can go from star to star with almost no time passing. They master hyperspace travel. They leave our material belt. The spacecraft leave our material belt, which is the fourth rotational belt of our universe, and they enter into these other layers where time is very different, and they rematerialize in a different star system with almost no time passing. Another interesting thing happens in the fourth stage of evolutions with human societies, and that is that people become very good at genetic engineers. And we start to, you know, now we build computers which have a CPU, a central processing unit, which is a little chip which has wires and electricity runs through, and it functions as the brain of your computer. Well, in the future, in our future, in our distant future, we will create organic-based intelligence, which is sentient, which knows it's alive, which knows it's real. And the central computer of Semyasi's ship is an organic intelligence that's sentient. It's aware. She can communicate with that ship telepathically. So for all intents and purposes, her ship is a life form with a metallic hull. So that's the fourth stage of evolution. The fifth stage is creational wisdom. We can do amazing things at this stage. It's the last stage for a physical body. And that's the point I was trying to get to, is that in the next stage, in the sixth stage, we go into a half material state, half spiritual state. And finally, in the seventh stage, we're completely back to a spirit being. We have no need for a physical body anymore. And then we merge back into creation. Now, in page 216 of the book, The Psyche, Billy gives the following clarification regarding the human spirit. He says, if now it is learned that the human being is animated by a tiny part piece of the creational spirit, then this means in no case that this is a part piece of the creational universal consciousness itself, however an energy and part piece merely created from it, which in self-independence forms the creational human spirit and also likewise independently evolves through the evolution of the human material consciousness. So the creation creates human spirit forms as a part of its own evolution. And each one of these spirit forms starts out with no knowledge, and each lifetime, this knowledge builds one lifetime after another. You see, we get these impulses from the storage banks and inspiration from our predecessor personalities. Now, at this point, it's very important that you understand that when you reincarnate, that you get a new personality each time, and that the new personality has nothing to do with the previous personality. So, and also Meyer Material says there's really not karma in the sense that sometimes the religions teach of karma. Anyway, I think it's very important that we clarify our thoughts on reincarnation. And I have a fascinating clip here from Ian Stevenson where children's past life memories are discussed.
This little boy is referred to as Sam in case studies. A year and a half before he was born, his grandfather died.
When he was about 18 months old, his dad was changing his diaper one day, and Sam looked up at him and said, "When I was your age, I used to change your diaper."
Since 1996, Dr. Jim Tucker, a psychiatrist at the University of Virginia, has been gathering case studies of past life recognition in children that could prove that a soul returns to Earth in another body.
We've now got 2,500 cases in our files from all over the world.
Many people believe in some form of reincarnation. The concept dates back to 800 BC and the Hindu Upanishads. Beginning in India, the belief that some essential part of ourselves may return after death to a new body is now being examined by some scientists as another way to prove the survival of consciousness. Can the study of past life recollections support this theory? The answer may lie within young children's memories.
Very young children, usually between the age of 2 or 3, who start reporting that they have memories from having had a past life. Some of them talk about being deceased relatives, but others will talk about being strangers in other locations. And if they give enough details, like the name of the other location, people have often gone there and found that, in fact, someone had died in the recent past whose life matches the details that the children gave.
The late psychiatrist Dr. Ian Stevenson advanced the field of reincarnation research in the 1960s, interviewing over 3,000 people who claimed to have past life memories. Two-thirds of them said that in a previous life, they died from unusual causes.
We'll listen to a little bit more of that information on past lives as well. I wanted to also discuss that there are many forms of life on the earth here, and there are different kinds of evolution for the different kinds of creatures that exist. Now, creation itself actually evolves, and it's called the spiritual energetical evolution of the creation. Now, from the perspective of the entire structure of our universe, it goes through what they call a great time, which is 311 years that's associated with this expansion and then a contraction. And each time the universe goes through the expansion and the contraction, it evolves into a new form of universe. And the universe that we live in is called the creational universe. It's the least evolved creational form. It's the creational universe. Now, after we go through the cycle of the expansion and contraction of our universe, the next time it is reborn, it is called the Ur-creation or Ur-universe, which is the next higher form up. There are actually 10 to the 49th power different categories of universes. So every time a universe expands and contracts, it evolves into the next form of universe. Now, 10 to the 49th power is such a huge number, I can't even, again, wrap my mind around it without experiencing cognitive dissonance. So I'm not going to try to make an analogy this afternoon, but there are many, many higher universes and higher evolution than our universe. I don't know if that's comforting or not, because in these higher universes, my understanding is there is no material belt. Now, again, our material belt is the fourth layer of our universe, and it contains the planets, the stars, the solar systems, the galaxies. Our scientists think there are about 100 to 200 different galaxies in our universe. And in all of these galaxies in our universe, there are human beings that reincarnate.
Children who talk about going to other realms like heaven, things like that. Some of them will talk about seeing other beings there or talking with God.
I died and shot up to heaven. God gave me a ticket that let me come back down to earth.
This is not part of our everyday experience to have people talking about past lives. If the children are able to describe memories that then turn out to be accurate for somebody who lived and died in the past, then this suggests that memories or something connected with memories can carry over possibly after the death of the body. I've had a number of friends and acquaintances who have said that their children, when they were two or three, would make one sort of unusual statement. Like there's one woman who said, her child said, "In my last life, I drove a big truck." This is as they're riding down the road one day. Never said anything else. And, you know, you don't make too much of that. But in these cases, the children don't stop after one or two statements.
When children continue to talk about having had a past life, they may offer more specific details.
Do you remember your family?
Some people turned my sister into a fish.
Who turned her into a fish?
Some bad guys. She died.
The father had only recently heard about the sister being murdered 60 years before, and then her body had been dumped in the bay, and he felt absolutely certain that the boy had never heard about it.
Some people point out what they believe to be flaws in Tucker's studies.
How do we...
Anyway, originally, again, there were 40,353,607 pure human races that were created by creation. And these human races, they start in a natural evolutionary manner on many planets and the many solar systems of the many galaxies throughout our universe. I think the Meyer material says that in the Milky Way galaxy, there are 7 million solar systems that have the potential to support higher life, and I believe there are about 3,600,000 human civilizations in our Milky Way galaxy. And these human races develop from natural biologic evolutionary processes within the developmental confines of their planet. So nature, although there are variations, it works pretty much in the same way. The evolution was such that first flora comes into being. So on these planets, when life starts to develop, first we have plants. And there's amino acids and chemical compounds associated with plants. And then after plants develop, you have the animal kingdom, the fauna, which also has a different set of amino acids associated with them. Now, eventually, human life is formed on all these different worlds and all these different planets and all these different solar systems that support life. And on different worlds, human beings can look very different. They may be giants by our standards. And we've talked about the Lyrians before, who were incredible giants by our standards, and who were at a much, much higher development than the native Earth humans when they came here. But there are also dwarf races, very, very small races. Let me read a little section here. Again, this is from an interview that Billy did. It's posted up on the FIGU Canada site. "And yet all of them were always indisputable human entities. Some of them were as small as gnomes, but others were dwarfs, colossi, giants, titans, to name a few. Among them, there were also human entities of a small stature who remained part of their own race. But due to genetic flaws, they never quite reached their normal height. These diminutive beings were not the same as dwarfs, for they are actually races who, even given to this day, continue to exist in the same manner. People of small stature still live, even here on the earth, but unfortunately they are being scorned and referred to as Lilliputians in a way reminiscent of the fictional novel Gulliver's Travels. And we have giants, to a certain degree, still on the earth in the Watusi and the Maasai tribes of Africa." So anyway, on all these different planets and all these different worlds and all these different solar systems and all these different galaxies of our universe, one of the creational natural laws that functions is reincarnation.
Explains the nightmares and James's strange obsession with airplanes.
I talked to my mom about it a lot of times. My mom said maybe he's remembering a past life.
What did you say?
Politely, baloney.
Andrea and Bruce of Lafayette, Louisiana, are a highly educated, modern couple. To them, the possibility that their little son James was manifesting signs of a former life was, well, a little out there.
You know, having a past life is not the initial conclusion that you come to. You try and figure out any other way he could have. Did he see anything? Has there ever been anything on television, anything that we've discussed?
But as time went by, Andrea didn't know what to believe. Here is James at age 3, going over a plane as if he's doing a pre-flight check. He would continue to say and do things that were puzzling, like the time his mom bought him a toy airplane.
And I said, oh, look, there's a bomb on the bottom of it. He said, that's not a bomb, Mama, that's a drop tank.
A drop tank?
I'd never heard of a drop tank. I didn't know what a drop tank was.
Andrea's mother suggested she look into the work of counselor and therapist Carol Bowman. Bowman has written 2 books, both supporting the proposition that sometimes the dead can be reborn.
We are taught from a very early age in this culture, in the Judeo-Christian culture, that reincarnation doesn't exist. Once you observe this in a child, and the evidence is very compelling, you have to open up to another explanation for what is going on.
Bruce was deeply skeptical.
He said there has to be a logical explanation.
I don't believe in past lives. I don't believe in this stuff.
But with the violent nightmares recurring 3 and 4 times a week, the Leinigers felt they had to do something. So with guidance from Bowman, they cautiously began to encourage James to share his memories. They say the result was startling.
The nightmares immediately started reducing in frequency. He went down from 3 or 4 times a week to maybe 1 a week, 1 every other week. And at that point was when he started to articulate more about these past life memories.
Seems normal enough, a little boy improving when his troubles are directly addressed. But Bowman says this is more, that James was forthcoming because this is the age when former lives are most easily recalled.
They haven't had the cultural conditioning, the layering over of experience in this life, so that the memories can percolate up more easily. These memories tend to fade between the ages of 5 to 7.
His parents say between the ages of 2 and 4, James would reveal extraordinary details about the life of a former fighter pilot, mostly at bedtime, when he was drowsy.
Bruce said, what happened to your plane? He said, it crashed on fire. And Bruce said, why did your airplane crash? And he said, it got shot. And Bruce said, well, who shot your plane? And I'll never forget the look on his face. He went, the Japanese.
Still, despite these extraordinary stories, Bruce...
So the young boy, James Leiniger, recalls very specific details about his past life. He recalled the name of the aircraft carrier that he flew off of, called the Natoma Bay. He recalled the aircraft that he flew, which was a Corsair. He recalled the name of the other officers that he flew with. And the parents in that clip will verify those names. James Leiniger was accurate in all those cases. Now, past life memory is not typical. Typically, we don't remember our past lives. But at times that occurs, and I wonder if that occurs in cases where there are traumatic deaths, where people's lives were cut short. That seems to be a pattern that shows up in the research. I don't know that we could always say that's the case. I wanted to talk a little bit about 2 different categories of life forms that the Meyer material talks about. It talks about the Wesenheit, which is the creational universal consciousness. And Wesenheiten are stones, water, certain energies and gases that do not evolve the same way as we Wizen do. And Wizen are independently existing life forms that have their own individuality and personality. And there are three kinds of evolution in Wizen. There is consciousness-based, which is human beings. There is impulse-based evolution, which occurs in plants. And there is an instinct-based or an intelligence-based evolution for animals. Now, when the little embryo is inside the mother's womb and the human spirit has not entered in to the superior colliculus area, the embryo lives on impulse-based, naturally instinctive evolution. It has no consciousness yet. It has no personality of its own. Now, on the 21st day, the embryo is then animated, and it receives a spirit form into the embryo. And then it gets its consciousness and personality. Again, then that plant-based impulse evolution switches over to human-based consciousness evolution. And a human being starts to evolve. Let's pick up back again with our clip on reincarnation.
He goes, "Daddy, that's where my airplane was shot down." And I said, "What?" "That's my airplane got shot down there, Daddy." And I just went, blank. I couldn't say anything.
By then, Bruce had become a man possessed, searching the internet, combing through military records, and interviewing men who served aboard the Natoma Bay. Finally, a breakthrough. He learned that there was just one pilot from the squadron killed at Iwo Jima. That pilot, James M. Houston, Jr. Is this why little James was calling himself James 3?
It just crystallized in my mind. This has to be who we're talking about. You know, my meter of skepticism was starting to go over toward belief.
When little James would describe being shot down, he told of how his plane had sustained a direct hit on the engine.
We had an airplane, and I said, "Well, can you show me where it was?" And he pointed right up to the front of the engine.
That's what makes this man's story so intriguing. His name is Ralph Klarber. Klarber was a rear gunner on a TBM Avenger that flew off the Natoma Bay. On March 3rd, 1945, he took part in a raid near Iwo Jima. As it happens, Barber's plane was right next to the one flown by James M. Houston, Jr. It was to be Hugh's last mission before leaving for home the following day. As Barber recalls, the sky was thick with enemy flak.
We experienced pretty heavy anti-aircraft fire, but this was the most intense that I experienced at any time.
Suddenly, a flash through the nose of Houston's plane.
I saw the hit. I would say he was hit head-on. Right on the middle of the engine.
Just as little James had described it.
So what do you believe now about your son James?
I believe that he had a past life. I believe that in his past life he was James M. Houston, Jr. And he came back because he wasn't finished with something. And that's essentially what I believe.
Dear Bruce and Andrea.
And he is not the only one. This past October, the Leinigers received a letter from a woman named Anne Barron, the sister of pilot James Houston. Andrea and Bruce had contacted her about their little boy. Barron heard about what young James was saying, and she believes.
All of this is still overwhelming. I can only imagine how it has affected you, but I believe, with my love to you, Anne. The child was so convincing and coming up with all these things that there's no way in the world he could know unless there is a spiritual thing.
I think that the parents are self-deceived, that they're fascinated by the mysterious, and they've built up a fairy tale.
Professor Paul Kurtz of the University of Buffalo.
Anyway, James Leiniger's previous incarnation evidently was James M. Houston, Jr., who was shot down in a Corsair during World War II in the Pacific Theater fighting against the Japanese. It was interesting that young James Leiniger knew exactly where his plane was hit. in the center of the engine, which was corroborated by one of the other pilots that were flying there. Of course, the scientists, some scientists are skeptical. Let's continue on with our clip here.
Those things.
I knew what he watched on television. I knew what stories I read to him. I'm a protective, first-time Southern mother. There was no other place he could have been getting this information.
Assuming the Linux are acting in good faith, what we have here is a classic conflict of faith versus science. Hard facts against beliefs that often can't be easily explained. There's no doubt where Paul Kurtz stands.
People have a right to believe, surely in America, there's freedom of conscience. On the other hand, do you want to believe in something that is false?
So how do you rationalize a belief in anything bigger than ourselves if you have to fall back on science all the time?
Not simply science, on the facts, on common sense.
Once upon a time, the Leinigers might have agreed, but that was before the amazing stories told by their young son forced them to consider the possibilities and to examine their faith.
Whether you believe in reincarnation or not, it's about the eternal life of the human spirit.
That's right.
And that's something God promises to us. There is something else out there after this. It's not over when you die.
James's vivid recollections are starting to fade as he gets older, but among his prized possessions are two gifts sent to him by pilot James Houston's sister, a bust of George Washington and a model of a Corsair aircraft. They were among the personal effects of James Houston sent home after the war.
Do you feel differently about James? Has this changed your relationship with him?
No. We have always felt that he's a special little boy because he's our son. He appears to have experienced something that I don't think is unique, but the way it's been revealed is quite astounding.
There you go.
Good hit, buddy. It doesn't change how we think. I don't look at him and say, that's not my son, that's someone else. That's my boy.
Good one. It might be a natural assumption that it's just Buddhists and Hindus who believe in reincarnation, but would it surprise you to know that one out of every four Americans, Christians and Jewish alike, believe that souls do return again in different bodies? We'll be right back.
One of the things that a knowledge of reincarnation gives you is a different perspective. So you no longer have the perspective of living just one life, but you have the perspective that you have to come back to the planet that you're currently living on. And I think that helps us to understand the importance of taking responsibility while you're here, particularly for our environment. And one of the things, unfortunately, that we're doing on our world today is destroying our natural environment. And one of the main reasons we're destroying our environment is because our population on the Earth is very, very high. For example, there is a country beside India called Bangladesh. It has a population of 167 million people. Now, in the state I live in, Ohio, we have a relatively small population compared to that. We have a population of about 11.5 million. Now, can you imagine a population of 167 million people? Now, that causes cognitive dissonance. In other words, we can't really imagine that. But there are countries in the world today where populations are running wild. Now, when that happens, they build mega cities which destroy forests, which destroy farmland, which destroy many habitats for animals. In Dhaka, in Bangladesh, there's one of these mega cities with 15 million people in them. That's more people than are in the state of Ohio. The other thing that occurs with overpopulation is the destruction or the depletion of water, fresh water. Now, in the United States, we have the largest, one of our largest aquifers. It's called the Ogallala aquifer. It's about 178,000 square miles in the center of our country. It is getting depleted. It used to be 240 feet deep. It's now 80 feet deep on average, with some areas dried up completely. And there's a town in Texas, for example, called Happy, ironically, but they have no water. Now, the Ogallala Aquifer is the aquifer that allowed us to have that tremendous agricultural base in the breadbasket of America. In the next couple decades, it will become too expensive to use agriculture in that area because the water in that aquifer will be too depleted. It takes about 6,000 years for that aquifer to refresh itself, according to scientists. Let's listen to the trouble in Bangladesh as their population grows. The slum dwellers there struggle for clean water.
As the cause of death. The hospital's lead research scientist, Dr. S.K. Roy, and his colleagues work around the clock, 365 days a year, to save lives threatened by waterborne illness. The majority of the patients here are the urban poor, and the hospital care is free.
We are now having about 400 patients every day. But in August, September, sometime we go up to 1,200 a day. And I can tell you the average of a year is 120,000 patient average in a year. So this hospital is a quite busy one. Most of them having E. coli diarrhea, cholera diarrhea. Then we are having a typhoid patient, quite high number. So these are coming through water and hand behavior, hand contamination.
Most diarrhea patients are released within 12 to 24 hours of receiving treatment. But at a nearby clinic, two newcomers to Dhaka have been battling the illness for 5 days. Fazila Begum believes her baby, Saeem, became ill after drinking water from a shared well. When the baby is finally cleared to leave, the attending doctor warns Fazila that Saeem is in precarious shape and needs safe drinking water, regular meals, and rest. Fazila rents a small room at a nearby slum for $20 a month. She shares cooking, water, and toilet facilities with 25 neighbors. Neighbors say the shared well provided by the landlord is not deep enough to avoid contamination. Many here...
It's hard for us to understand the human misery in some of these third world countries because we're so removed from that. What's happening in these third world countries, for example, like India, 4 million people are born on the street every year. 4 million people die on the street every year. In some countries in Africa, women will have, for example, have 8 children, 6 of which will starve to death. So you can't imagine the human suffering that is taking place. Much of this suffering is because of overpopulation. Overpopulation leads to diseases, and it's really not a space issue. Most people argue, they'll make the argument that, well, you could fit the whole population of the world into an area of Texas or whatever that, something of that effect. But well, we have the whole southern part of the Earth, Antarctica, 4.5 million square miles. You could take all the people of the Earth down there quite easily. The problem is it's not a desirable place to live. The temperature's 50, 60, 70 degrees below zero. People migrate to the areas where the forests are, and that's why our forests are being destroyed. The rainforest, for example, is being depleted because people need food and the bigger populations demand more food. Let's pick back up with the struggle in Bangladesh here.
Their revenues. On the other hand, poor people, they want the service. And they immediately see the economic advantage of getting access to Dhaka Wasa water supply because that is cheap in comparison to private market. So in that way, it started.
NGO-backed water access points like this one are now sprouting up in the slums all over Dhaka. Each community forms a water committee that pays to install the pump and for the costs of operation and maintenance. These committees also collect and pay the water bills. The success of earlier NGO-backed water points now enables community groups in slums to negotiate directly with the city for legal water access without NGO help.
Anybody living in urban slums, they can apply for the service, and if they are willing to pay for the service, DWS has no problem.
Today, there are over 1,000 water connections in 100 slums, but that leaves some 5,000 slums with no such service.
Still today, there are slums and squatters where these services are not available.
With new residents like Fazila and Saim arriving every week, the need for more city-to-slum water connections will remain urgent.
Steve's report was a partnership with the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. For more on the Population Project, follow a link on our website at newshour.pbs.org.
Billy talks about the third millennium, which is the time that we're in now. And when Billy was a young boy meeting with Sfath, Sfath would talk about the third millennium. And he would tell Billy that a time of confusion and misery was coming over the earth, and that our leaders would become megalomaniacal, and that people would become indolent, meaning lazy and obtuse, slow to understand, and that this would produce a kind of ambivalence and disinterest in people, and also set the stage for conflicts. Our self-determination will be taken away in the third millennium. Our leaders are taking away our rights of right to bear arms, the right to the freedom of speech, the right to make decisions concerning our health, mandatory vaccinations, gun controls, what I'm talking about. There is a globalist agenda to create a dumbed-down, domesticated society where they have put fluoride in our water to dumb us down. They are changing the curriculums at the schools. Many people today can't even think for themselves anymore. They've lost that ability to think for themselves. And in the third millennium, we're going to see certain things occur. Let me read this to you. And this is what people's thought processes will be in this third millennium. Therefore, you are becoming ever more indifferent to one another, more mistrustful of one another, and increasingly emotionless, disinterested, indolent, and obtuse in interpersonal relationships, which is causing simple human connections to be destroyed and entire families to be ruined. Under such unbearable circumstances, many among you will feel blazing anger rise up in you and will therefore torment other fellow human beings and even extract revenge on them. And I want to read a little bit of Larry Driscoll's translation of Contact Report 72 and what it says about people's actions towards one another. This is the reason for this rapid succession is that the work is not allowed to lie fallow. In other words, the people in Figo are going to be reincarnating more often and must be continued forward so that the knowledge, despite all the coming confusion and maliciousness, so our world will be filled with confusion and maliciousness, and it will slowly spread over the your world, because only as a result will those of the enormously further growing humanity grasp the knowledge and be guided into the path of true evolution. So the information in the Meyer material will eventually guide humanity into a true evolution. Now, overpopulation is one of the things that interrupts and destroys true evolution, because it destroys the natural environment and it makes life so difficult that you're struggling to survive and you don't have the opportunity to evolve the way that you should. So let's talk again
about resources like water, oil, and wood will finally run out. The battle for fresh water is already a big issue in Africa. Poor people simply cannot cover the costs of water, and the gap between the rich and downtrodden is getting bigger. This and the fact that people are also forced to live closely to each other, causing friction and irritations, can lead to major social tensions. But these social changes are not the only changes that occur. A strong growth in populace affects the earth and her inhabitants in various other ways, such as on a physical, geographical, and demographical level. There is a discussion whether the growing population is connected with climate change, and in particular, the greenhouse effect, pollution, and the heightened carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere. Changes in demographics will not go unnoticed. We are getting older, and at the same time, the continuing population growth could result in one-child policies, or even having offspring at a later age. In 1979, China introduced the one-child policy. The purpose of this was to halve the population in one generation, but this brings forth another issue. The labor force, the actual number of people available for work, will be too small to support the economy in 2025.
Okay, I wanted to also bring up another point about overpopulation, because overpopulation also leads to people becoming ever more uneducated. And let me read what the Meyer material says here. But the effects of overpopulation, oh goodness, don't ever adjust your browser size. But the effects of overpopulation are also demonstrated by human beings become ever more uneducated. So the higher this overpopulation comes, the more we'll be uneducated. And we will become addicted to evil vices, habits, and degenerations, whereby the most common forms are especially alcohol, drugs, excessive seeking of pleasure and craving for travel, as well as degenerated sexual cravings. So for some reason, that this overpopulation, it leads to people becoming more and more uneducated, because I think it lowers the whole standard of living. People, again, are struggling to survive. They can't go and study. So this is like it's a spiral of degeneracy, and that's what's happening in the world today.
In order to do this, we need to understand the way the planet reacts to our activities. Building a closed-off system without interaction with the outer world will give us the ability to study the steps needed to colonize Mars. Texel, an island in the Wadden Sea in Holland, gives us a good place to build this complex. The complex consists of two enormous domes, connected by bridges. One dome is used to simulate Mars and how to terraform it. Terraforming means that the atmosphere is artificially adjusted to make it habitable for life. Before you do this on a worldwide scale, it's better to do this on a smaller, more controllable scale. Mars is about 1.5 times as far from the Sun as Earth, and is about half the size of our blue planet. Martian
scientists who recognize the overpopulation problem are already talking about moving parts of the population to Mars and trying to terraform Mars. I think this is going to be a very difficult thing to do.
Successfully, we need to know what kind of impact these cycles of Mars have on Earth organisms. In the dome, we'll be able to control the day and season cycle, but unfortunately not the gravity. The other dome is to simulate Earth. This dome is completely self-sufficient and does not require anything from the outside to operate. Eventually, this building can be transported to or be built on Mars. There has been previous experiments to simulate Earth, such as the BIOS 3 and the Biosphere 2. BIOS 3 was built in Krasnoyarsk, Russia. It was only 315 square meters and could support 3 people. There were 4 compartments, 1 living quarters, one algae cultivator, and two phytrins. Phytrins are areas where crops could grow, and the algae was used to recycle the air. The whole complex reached an efficiency of 85%. The Biosphere 2 is a facility of the University of Arizona that's currently used to research ecosystems. With almost 2.5 acres, this complex can support 8 people and features 2,500 square meters of agriculture, 1,900 square meters of rainforest, 1,400 square meters of desert, 1,300 square meters of savanna, 850 square meters of ocean with a coral reef, 450 square meters of mangrove, and sufficient.
Anyway, that clip was talking about Mars, and I just wanted to bring something up that we've talked about before in the past, that the origins of Earth humanity is very interesting. And originally, we had a naturally developing Earth human here that appeared on the scene 4 to 5 million years ago, maybe 9 million, something like that. There's a life form called Adelos bassialis cromtoni, which kind of looked like a shrew, about 225 million years ago, appeared on the Earth, and it was the original mammal that led to the development of man. Now, the paleontologist that discovered this Adelobasialis cromtrone was a guy by the name of Adrian Hunt. Now, he developed this he discovered a tiny little skull of this animal that looks somewhat like a shrew, and the scientists have been able to link Adelos bassialis cromtoni to the primates. And the Meyer material says humanity developed from the primates. Well, in the ancient past, human beings also came here. Space traveler, highly advanced society. So what we've had on the Earth is naturally developing humans as well as these very advanced societies. And the megalithic structures, some of these megalithic structures were designed by these advanced humans who came here from the Lyra Vega system. Now, we've talked about the Lyra Vega system in the past and how the Lyrians came here and intercommingled with the people of the Earth and violated certain laws and rules that they had, and they produced an offspring that was a cross between the Lyra Vegans and the natural Earth peoples. Well, many of these Lyrians went under what was called a codex. They came here about 289,000 years ago in mass. Some of them committed these crimes, were left here stranded on the Earth. Their technology was taken, and they died here on the Earth. The planet that you die on is the planet that you reincarnate on, and that's one of the creational natural laws. So we have older spirit forms here that have locked within their predecessor personalities these memories of very, very advanced societies. We also had a group of people that came here from the Cirrus system that bore somewhat barbaric traits. They had been genetically manipulated to fight and defend what they called the creator overlords in the Cirrus system in a different space-time configuration. They traveled to Mars and they set up civilizations on Mars. And because of, in ancient times, a destroyer comet penetrated the Martian orbit and wrenched Mars into another orbit. And this caused a great upheaval on Mars. So a lot of these people were wiped out, and the ones that survived came to the Earth. Now, these were the people who bore the barbaric traits and the shortened lifespan. They came to the Earth, and since then, those barbaric traits and shortened lifespan have been passed to all the people that exist here on the Earth. You know, the Plearen have a 1,000-year lifespan. And even our own Bible talks about, in ancient times, our lifespan being much, much longer. Now, when this genetic manipulation was passed through all the people of Earth, the lifespans came shortened. Also, according to the Meyer material, one thing that shortens our lifespan are these ancient, or these religions, which distorted the creative natural laws, which distorted the teaching of the spirit. And now these religions create a kind of internal dissonance. But anyway, we were listening to that clip. We were talking about Mars and how we're talking about going back to Mars. Well, some of us came from Mars, and there were cities, pyramids, stations, and other things on Mars until that large destroyer comet came through that was 1.72 times the mass of the Earth, and it wrenched Mars into a different orbit. There was another planet besides Mars that supported life called Melona, which you've talked about before. The people on Melona fought each other, and they ended up exploding, destroying their own planet when they diverted a ocean into a giant volcano, which ended up destroying. So there were actually three planets here in the solar system that supported life in our very, very ancient past. And unfortunately, it does seem like that we're heading back into a cycle of degeneration. And we're already starting to see some of the prophecies, and like the Henoch prophecies, come through. And part of it, I think, of the signs of this degeneracy, we're starting to see in these things like Ferguson, Missouri, where we're seeing the shootings and the riots and things like that.
God bless his soul. Police shot this boy outside my apartment. They kill him.
He didn't have to do anything like that. He didn't have to do it.
And so when he turned and faced him and put his hands up, was he standing still at that point?
Yes.
And then do you know how many more shots you think the officer fired after he stood and put his hands up?
Several. I didn't count them, but it was several.
Several more.
And I'm looking, I'm watching the officer, he's pursuing my friend now, that he fired another shot. Then my friend stopped running, his hands immediately went in the air, and he turned around towards the officer face to face. He started to tell the officer that he was unarmed and that you should stop shooting me. Before he can get his second sentence out, the officer fired several more shots into his head and chest area, and he fell dramatically in the fatal position. I did not hear once he yelled, freeze, stop, or halt. It was just horrible to watch.
At the end, he just turned around after, I'm guessing, he felt the bullet graze his arm. He turned around and then was shot multiple times.
About time I gets outside, he's already turned around, facing the officer. He's balled up. He have his arms, like, under his stomach, and he was, like, halfway down, like he was going down.
Mm-hmm.
And the officer lets out about 3 or 4 shots at him.
We were walking down the street, an empty street. We were just walking down, minding our own business. We're both headed home, and the officer is approaching us, and as he pulled up on the side of us, he didn't say freeze, halt, or nothing like we were committing a crime. He said, get the F on the sidewalk. I told the officer we were not but a minute away from the destination. He's at an angle where we're so close to his door and him that when he tries to thrust the door open aggressively, it didn't come an inch out before it strikes both of us. Arm extended out the window, grabbed my friend around the neck. He didn't say step back or anything like that. He started to pull.
So in the third millennium, the Meyer material says our leaders will become megalomaniacal. They will take away our rights of self-determination, and the people will become indolent and obtuse and indifferent, and this will lead to a kind of antagonism between people, and we're already seeing this antagonism and rage it talks about and anger it talks about in the Goblet of Truth that will be part of the third millennium, which is this transition period that we're moving through. And one of the historical trends in this third millennium, in this transition period, are wars. And we're going to see more wars, and we can always go all the way back to 1967. I have a clip here which talks about the Arab-Israeli War.
June 5th, 1967, 7:45 a.m. Israel delivers a stunning opening blow in the Six-Day War. Within a few hours, the Israeli airstrike has devastated the Egyptian Air Force. Fighting on three different fronts against the combined might of three Arab armies, Israel would win a war in the space of just 6 days. How did this tiny nation achieve one of the most astonishing victories in the history of warfare? Eyewitness testimony, unique access to secret military plans, and weapons testing reveal the extraordinary story of how Israel won the Six-Day War. In the Middle East were rising. Egyptian President Gamal Abdel Nasser had called on the Arab nations to destroy Israel. War seemed inevitable. Israel faced the grim prospect.
I want to talk a little bit about some of the prophecies in Contact Report 136, which took place on October of 1980. And these prophecies announce what's called the slowly approaching global decline. Again, we're talking about the third millennium here. Some of the prophecies that are discussed in Contact 136 are the assassination of John Lennon, the engagement of Prince Charles of England to Princess Diana and her death, the start of the trend of the extremely cold weather, the rise in earthquakes and floods, the rise of Zionism, Reagan setting the stage for World War III by turning America into this incredible military power, the assassination attempt on Reagan, the Israeli Air Force will attack and destroy an atomic power plant in Iraq, and I have some clips that talk about that. And then one of the other prophecies, I believe, does talk about this Arab-Israeli war that occurred in 1967. Pick back up here, but this is a trend we'll see, warfare.
And by Syria from the Golan Heights. And it seemed possible that both Jordan and Iraq would add their weight to the Arab force.
Now, the question was, can you defend this kind of a sliver of the Mediterranean if they attack? The answer is no.
The best form of defense would be a strong offense, a preemptive strike. But such a strategy created its own problems.
The Israelis could not afford to put all of their oomph against the Egyptians and the Jordanians and the Syrians at the same time. They had to concentrate. The Israelis had to concentrate their force against one enemy at a time.
To fight a war the way it wanted, Israel would need to gain air superiority. Once the Arab air forces had been dealt with, Israel could fight each of their ground forces in turn. In 1964, Sadan's team came up with an unorthodox plan.
The idea that we came to was to strike their airstrips.
These classified plans have remained secret for 40 years. They reveal how Israel would achieve air superiority. The primary objective would be to keep the Arab air forces on the ground.
By disabling the runways of the Egyptian air force, and then the Syrian, etc., etc., you prevent the aircraft from taking off.
Targeting the runways would take hundreds of Arab aircraft out of the equation. The plan was good, in theory. But what were its chances of success?
We had a problem there. They had tens of runways, more than 50. We had only 206 aircraft.
The problem they faced is a scenario the Israeli Air Force trains for to this day. How could the...
Anyway, another one of these prophecies that the Meyer material talks about was the bombing of the nuclear reactor that was at OSIRAQ. And this is, again, some of the prophecies regarding this slow global decline that we'll see in the third millennium.
At 3 p.m., the pilots marched onto the runway, climbed into their planes, and took off. This is the actual footage they recorded. The pilots could not communicate with each other for fear of being detected by the enemy's radar.
From the moment you go out from the briefing room up to the moment you pull up for the attack, there is no one single word on the radio communication in order not to expose yourself on the intelligence system on the other side. So it's a kind of a silent movie. And each one with himself, with his documents in the cockpit, maps.
The flying time is 1 hour 35. The location of the target was in the middle of the state of Iraq, 17 miles south of Baghdad. So the main concern wasn't the long flight of 600 miles, but the last 70 miles.
A second formation of Israeli F-15s provided cover for the F-16 bombers, ready to attack the Iraqis if they started to shoot. And then they saw the target.
Even before we pulled up from low altitude to higher altitude, one could see the walls they built.
Ironically, Saddam had built these walls to protect the reactor after the Iranian raid.
The dome was a kind of a gold type. The sun was western, low angle, so when the explosion took place, the whole thing went up in the air and glistened in the setting sun. And it was just a great moment, except that there was no music.
The entire attack took 2 minutes. Now it was time to break away, quickly. Iraqi jets and missiles would certainly be launched. One by one, the Israeli pilots radioed each other they completed the mission.
90 minutes away from home, and a lot of flying in Iraq.
The pilots, now all accounted for, braced themselves for the worst. Saddam's billion-dollar arsenal of jets and missiles in hot pursuit. But then, something inexplicable happened. Absolutely nothing. No missiles, no Iraqi jets, just a beautiful sunset all the way home. At 7 that evening.
So some would probably argue that the attack of the OSIRAQ reactor in Iraq was an act of Zionism. Zionism is this trend by Israel. It's a trend to kind of actually try to dominate the world. At least some would claim that, and some claim that there is an Israeli Zionistic presence here in the United States that's caused, and let's say that our government in many ways has been compromised. Anyway, I hope you've enjoyed this episode of Ohio Exopolitics. We'll be on Revolution Radio this evening. Have a good evening, and we'll talk to many of you sooner.